In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about fuel cells. Now, on the show, fairly recently, we did a number of shows about energy and energy policy in this country and where it is our energy comes from. And on some of these shows, the subject of the fuel cell came up. There are a lot of people that feel that there's great potential of fuel cells to power some common devices that we rely on. There are people who think that one day they may run our vehicles like buses and cars. They may power our offices and our homes. They might even power our laptop computers and our cell phones. So after having had a number of passing mentions of fuel cells, we thought, well, we ought to do a show and talk about fuel cells and try to talk about what they are, how they work, what are the applications, and what kind of research is going on. And that is what we will do this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest for the show is Scott Barnett. He is professor of materials science and engineering at the Robert McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science at Northwestern University. And we'll be talking a little bit about some of the research that he's been involved in and about the subject in a, we hope, in a pretty basic sort of way. Questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And anywhere else, if you're listening in Chicago or Western Indiana or Southern Illinois, any place that signal will travel, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Barnett, hello. Professor Barnett? Professor Barnett? Well, I seem to be having a little problem with our connection here. Now we'll try it again. Professor Barnett? Well, I'm not quite sure what the problem is. We'll have to see if we can get it straightened out. And because we're doing this with this nice high-quality phone connection that we have sometimes, can take advantage of, and because he's at Northwestern, we can do it that way. And it makes it almost sound like he's in the room here with me, but that he's not. So we'll see if we can get that straightened out, and we will talk with him in just a second. Maybe let me mention just what we'll be doing on some of the other shows this week. On the program on Thursday, we'll have our regular monthly program on children's health. Robert Bochak will be here. He is a pediatrician from Christie Clinic, and you can call in with whatever questions you have. Also on Thursday, we'll be talking with Brian Sykes. He's professor of human genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford, and we'll be discussing his book, The Seven Daughters of Eve, The Science That Reveals Our Genetic Ancestry. So that will be on Thursday. We're going to try again here. Professor Barnett?
Yes.
Oh, great. Great. Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. And when my producer, Travis, when he told you that what I had in mind was fuel cells for dummies, you wasn't kidding. So
okay.
That's so you'll have to humor me if I ask some questions that are painfully basic. But I expect that probably for a lot of people who will be listening to us, that's the level they'll be at. So to start out then, I guess, the question to ask is, at its most basic, what is a fuel cell?
Okay, well, it's a device that converts chemical fuels, say, for example, natural gas, directly into electricity without moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's perhaps the closest analogy would be a battery. And you can think of a fuel cell in a sense as a battery that will never wear out. Okay, so in a battery, the electrodes in the battery are being consumed as you use the battery up, and then you either have to replace the battery or perhaps you can recharge it. But in a fuel cell, instead of having electrodes that are consumed, you're continually feeding in air in this fuel to either sides of the device, and those are consumed. And so as long as you continue to feed in the air and fuel, you'll continue to generate electricity.
Mm. Well, that answers one of the basic things that I was a little unsure about, and that is this very point. What exactly is the difference between a battery and a fuel cell?
Mm-hmm.
So in the fuel cell, you have these two, you have two electrodes. At one, your fuel goes in. At the other, your oxidant goes in, which I guess is usually oxygen, which just comes out of the air, and that somehow then you have this chemical reaction that goes on involving the two that produces electricity.
Right. Well, Dave, I think you were deceiving me here. It sounds like you do know something about these things.
Oh, well, no. You know what they say about a little bit of knowledge being a dangerous thing.
Right.
That's about, I guess I couldn't explain to you exactly how it happens, but I get the idea that you have these two things. You have your fuel, you have your oxygen, and you have this kind of a medium, the electrolyte,
right,
that is the thing that essentially allows this to happen, and that there are different kinds of electrolytes. So for that reason, then there are different kinds of fuel cells. So depending on what it is that you pick to be the, is it correct to say that that sort of mediates the reaction between your two electrodes?
That's right. And I guess I would say that the mental picture you can have of the fuel cells is that there are these three components, and you can think of them maybe as three layers, the central layer being electrolyte and the two outside layers being electrodes. One electrode where the fuel is called the anode, and the electrode where the oxygen or air comes in is called the cathode. And I don't know if you want me to give you a little description of just sort of what happens in the operation of the device.
Okay. Do that.
The two electrodes are hooked up to an external circuit, and of course that's where you actually get the power out, is by connecting up to the two electrodes. And one way you can think about the device, and this isn't the same for all fuel cells, I'm going to describe maybe the simplest case in which you have air coming into the cathode. And the key ingredient there is the oxygen that's coming in, oxygen molecules. And the electrons also will come into the cathode from the external circuit. So the oxygen molecule will react with electrons and actually split up to become two oxygen ions, each ion carrying two electrons. And that happens more or less at the interface between the cathode and the electrolyte. Those oxygen ions are then migrate across the electrolyte. And that's really the role of the electrolyte. It's a medium that allows these ions to transport across it and carry a current across it. And once it gets to the other side of the electrolyte, to where the anode is, there's going to be a fuel there, and the reaction will occur between the oxygen ions and the fuel, and the fuel will become oxidized. So, for example, if it was natural gas that's primarily methane, the products would be carbon dioxide and hydrogen, or I'm sorry, not hydrogen, water coming off. And then those electrons that got carried across the electrolyte go back into the anode and back out into the external circuit, and the fuel cell then forces that current to flow around the circuit, and that's how you get your electrical power out. So you're actually, I guess you would say you're electrochemically burning the fuel, but you don't actually have a flame like you would in a normal combustion process.
And that's where you get the advantage of the fuel cell. That is, because you're not burning anything, you're not getting the byproducts of combustion that we get from burning fossil fuels that are problematic for a variety of reasons.
That's right. It's useful in thinking about this to compare a fuel cell with a conventional way of producing electricity, which is normally use a mechanical device like a turbine or a piston engine, in which you actually burn the fuel directly with air, and that mechanical energy is then run into an electrical generator, which produces the electricity. So it's a two-step process. But unfortunately, that combustion process is somewhat inefficient usually, and it also it's a source of pollution, that normal burning process. So certainly one of the key advantages that have always been touted for fuel cells is improved efficiency and lower pollution because of the direct oxidation process.
And I guess, as I have heard people talk about this and when I have read about it before now, just the little I've read about it makes it sound like a sort of a miraculous thing that essentially gives you energy for free. And I guess one has to remember that, in fact, you still need to have a fuel. You have to have something to put into the one side to have the reaction go. So we're still talking about using possibly, if you can get pure hydrogen, I guess you can use it. You can also use methane. I know at Argon they're actually working on a fuel cell that uses gasoline. And I guess there are some others that are potential. So we still have to. We still may be thinking about using fuels, having to use fuels that, as far as we know, are finite. So at least we still, in some of these cases, do have a little bit of a problem when it comes to what it is we're going to use for the power, essentially for the fuel source.
Right. These things are not cold fusion or a miraculous source of power like that, but they certainly can have some key advantages that if we can implement these things in the next couple decades, I think that could really improve our overall quality of life, both by basically reducing the amount of fuel that we have to consume to get the electricity we need, and also reducing the pollution that's produced in that process.
So I was just going to say, do it observe, even, for example, if we were using a fuel cell like this, the ones that they're working on at Argonne to power a car, for example, that uses gasoline, we would still be having to use petroleum to make the gasoline, but we would get more out of the gasoline that we do now with an internal combustion engine. That would be one advantage. The other advantage would be that we wouldn't have the air pollution that we have now.
That's right. I mean, I guess in the context of an automobile, you could just think of it as that you could improve your mileage considerably. So your gas bill goes down and our reliance on petroleum goes down because of that.
Mm. Well, for anybody who's tuned in here probably, I should introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Scott Barnett. He is professor of materials science and engineering at the Robert R. McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science at Northwestern University. And in his work, one of the things he has been doing is been working on fuel cells, and that's what we're talking about this morning. We're trying to do a basic kind of conversation about the fuel cell, what it is, how it works, its applications, and basically where things stand with fuel cells as energy generators. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. So I just mentioned at the beginning of the program that there are different types of fuel cells. They are named for the electrolytes they use. Correct me if I'm wrong about this, what you're doing there, the work that you have done, involves a solid oxide fuel cell?
That's right.
That's right. So this is a thing that has, I guess, some of the fuel cells, like a battery, have electrolytes that are liquid, but this one, in this particular case, there's no liquid in your fuel cell?
That's right. The solid oxide fuel cell or ceramic fuel cell is really the only one in which it's an all-solid-state device. The other ones usually have some sort of liquid electrolyte. And the other thing that distinguishes a solid oxide fuel is that it typically higher operating temperature than most of the other fuel cell types. Those are usually down around room temperature or slightly above.
Mm-hmm. That is, and here with the ones that you're talking about, we're talking about hundreds of degrees. Yeah, operating temperature.
That's right. In fact, until the last 10 years or so, the typical solid oxide fuel cell operated at about 1,000 degrees centigrade, which is a really quite high temperature.
And when we talk about potential applications then, the kind of a solid oxide fuel cell, the kind that you're working on here, we might be thinking about the possibility of, say, using this to have some large fixed sort of installation like a power plant, for example?
That has definitely been the traditional outlook for a solid oxide fuel cell is for relatively large stationary power plants. I should say, though, that they would probably be somewhat smaller power plants than than the really large mega power plants that you see. And one of the advantages that people talk about is the opportunity for developing more of a distributed power system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in which you tend to locate smaller power sources right at the need for the power source. And that's an advantage because you reduce the need for running power lines all over it, and there's some, of course, loss of efficiency when you run those power lines. The other advantage is that if you can, for example, have a, let's say, a small industry or a hotel or apartment building that was run locally by a fuel cell, is that you can also use to advantage the heat that's produced by the device for space heating, hot water heating, and that can actually further increase the efficiency of the process, because now you're using both the electricity and the heat, which is in a remote power plant is normally just dumped and lost, can actually be utilized to advantage. And that, I guess that the reason that that's feasible with a fuel cell and maybe not with a turbine power plant is because of the fact that it's a very quiet, low pollution device, and you you don't mind putting a power plant right in a neighborhood or in a populated area when it's a fuel cell power plant.
Mm. I guess it's my understanding that there are some places where they're looking at, and these may be different, I'm not sure, different kind of fuel cells than that you have worked on. But apparently in another number of places in the United States, but also Germany, Japan, they're looking at some very large ones. I guess the biggest one was at one time, was in Japan, an 11-megawatt fuel cell.
That sounds right. I'm not sure exactly what the size of it was, but they have been running fuel cells in Japan quite a bit as demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a variety of other locations.
I came across an article that apparently in the Chicago area, they're going to be doing some testing on residential fuel cells. So that is the idea that instead of a furnace in your house, you could have a fuel cell.
Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of interest in that application for the last few years. I noticed, in fact, that we're having a thunderstorm come in here right now, and one of the problems we have occasionally is power outages. And if you have your own little fuel cell power plant in the basement, you don't have to worry about the food going bad in your refrigerator or whatever else happens when the power goes out.
I guess the idea of the fuel cell has been around for a long time, since before the turn of the last century, and the term itself was coined in 1889, so people have been experimenting on these for a long time. What, though, were some of the problems involved in actually making them work and getting the technology to the point where it is now?
Well, I guess you could categorize it into sort of two main problems that there have been. One of them is that fuel cells really, until recently, run only on hydrogen as the fuel. And there's problems with availability of hydrogen and transporting hydrogen, generating hydrogen. It's just not the kind of fuel that we normally use. Mm. We use liquid fuels like propane and gasoline and diesel, and we have natural gas usually available in our homes. But normally fuel cells just do not run on those fuels, and you have to do special things to get them to work with those fuels. And the other one has really been the sort of engineering fuel cell system at a reasonable cost, and it's really an engineering problem. Scientifically and technologically, the fuel cells work quite nicely, but there are competing technologies out there that in our economy, in order for a technology to become commercially viable, it has to be cost effective. And even if fuel cells have advantages, if they cost significantly more than the alternative approach, people aren't going to use them.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think has to happen before the idea of a fuel cell would become cost effective? And is the issue how it is we're going to, what sort of fuel we're going to use, or is it more an issue of getting the technology right and then being able to manufacture them at a cost that's reasonable to think about?
Yeah, I think the manufacturing is the problem, because in bringing in a new technology like this, the people that do manufacturing, the key thing is that once you develop your production process and get it bigger and bigger, you get economies of scale and the cost drops down. But until you've gotten to that point, it's maybe difficult to get market penetration through technology to make it worth building that large production plant. So it's sort of a catch-22 situation. And, you know, the government, for example, Department of Energy, realizes this, and they're doing things to promote people to develop the production capability for fuel cells. For example, in demonstration power plants, they'll help subsidize the cost of installing a demonstration plant and so forth. But that's really a key issue, is how do you get up to a large enough scale production to really bring costs down to competitive levels.
Mm-hmm. We're about at the midpoint of this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Scott Barnett from Northwestern University. He is professor of materials science and engineering at the McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science. And we're talking about fuel cells. He's been involved in this research. And if you have questions, you certainly should call in. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us. So even if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. You talked about the fact that basically fuel cells you have two broad classes, those that run at low temperatures and those that run at high temperatures. And they're sort of different, and they lend themselves to different applications. If you have one that runs basically at room temperature, then maybe that's the one you could think about more reasonably using for your laptop or your car or your bus. And that the high temperature ones, if you're building a big plant, then maybe you think about that as a big power station, or maybe even heating your home. I know in some of the work that you've done, yours is the solid oxide is a one that runs at a high temperature, and you've managed to get the temperature down. How much further do you think you can get your operating temperature of your fuel cell down? Or is at some point where, because of the laws of physics, you say it's just never going to get down below a particular point?
Well, it's not really a laws of physics, but it's the materials we have available to work with. Mm. And we have and other groups have been able to get solid oxide fuel cells running down to 600 or 700 degrees centigrade. So it's considerably lower than where we were at, say 10 years ago when it was 1,000 degrees centigrade. Mm-hmm. And with existing materials, it looks in principle feasible to get down as low as about 400 degrees centigrade. And if we could do that, that would certainly be very exciting. But even at 600 degrees centigrade, the sort of traditional picture that you described is for the applications of fuel cells has changed somewhat. Hmm. And the issue really is a sort of a combination of the operating temperature and what kind of fuels you can use. And an advantage of a solid oxide fuel cell, and particularly some of the recent work that we've been doing at University of Pennsylvania, is that it's becoming clear that you can actually directly use a variety of fuels in these fuel cells. And this is in contrast to the low temperature category, for in particular the polymer-based fuel cells and that operate at fairly low temperatures. You're really restricted to fairly pure hydrogen as the fuel. There is one example in which people have been able to run on methanol, and that's the case in which you can have a portable generator. So you'd have a small methanol tank. And you could actually envision running, say, a laptop, a computer from that. But there's actually been a lot of interest for those sorts of applications now in solid oxide fuel cells, in which you would have, instead of methanol, actually a source of fuel, for example, propane or butane, or even something like gasoline or diesel as the fuel. And so the advantage is that those fuels actually have a much higher energy density than something like methanol, or certainly much higher than hydrogen. Mm. So that means that if you want to have a compact package, those fuels are advantageous because you need to carry much less fuel. Right. The disadvantage, of course, is still that the temperature is above room temperature, and you would actually need to have to insulate the device to protect the consumer from getting burned.
But there, I guess then it would be, one could imagine the possibility of using a solid oxide fuel cell in a car, for example?
Certainly, and there are people and numerous companies that are pursuing that application right now. It's actually, interestingly, the solid oxide fuel cell development has been primarily for what people call an auxiliary power unit. Mm-hmm. It's not actually for the main drive traction of the car, but it's for providing electricity for the auxiliaries that one has in the car. And the automakers are envisioning that there will be more and more electronics in an automobile as time goes on. And in fact, as I understand it, they're looking to go from 12 volts to 42 volts at some point to be able to run more electronics. Right. And the idea, I think, is to have this APU, or auxiliary power unit, run with a solid oxide fuel cell, hopefully running directly off gasoline, that would produce maybe as much as 5 kilowatts of power to run the electronics in an automobile.
We have a caller here, somebody on a cell phone, so let's get them in here on our line number 4 right there. Hello.
Hi, thanks for your time.
Sure.
I got a couple questions for you. There's a number of companies developing fuel cell systems for your home, the residential fuel cell systems, and one of which also captures that heat energy and it supplements your furnace.
Right.
And I was curious what they anticipate the dependability or the maintenance of those units to be over a long period of time compared to like a generator or a furnace, because if I understand correctly, there are no or very few moving mechanical parts. So I was kind of curious on that topic.
You know, I don't know the details for those companies of what they're promising. I know that in principle, the fuel cell systems, for the reasons you mentioned, can be extremely reliable. You don't have a lot of things that are going to wear out. And you'll see people showing demonstrations where power plants have been run continuously for as long as, I think, 7 or 8 years without break and without problems. So I think that maybe initially there'll be some bugs, but after a while I think these could be very reliable devices.
So they should have a very long, I guess, useful life, or however you want to phrase it.
Right.
Okay. What do you see as far as the implementation or commercialization of the residential fuel cells? What kind of time frame? Or the automobiles as well? I've heard automobiles probably take a little bit longer, a lot related to the type of fuel and how do you change gas stations to the different, you know, types of fuel and a lot of logistics and things like that. But how do you anticipate those two markets growing?
Well, I think if I remember, one of the companies is called Plug Power that's trying to develop this home generation system.
Yep.
And last time I heard them talking about it, they were wanting to have products on the market in a couple of years, which I think is very aggressive, but maybe it is possible. For the automotive case, again, there's sort of two categories. There's fuel cells that would actually provide the electricity to run the traction drive of the automobile, and then there's the auxiliary power unit.
Oh, okay.
And I think the auxiliary power units are perhaps closer because that's an easier problem. I don't know if that I've heard any estimates as to when that's going to happen. That's primarily, I think, Delco, that spinoff from GM, that's developing APUs.
That's just a less demanding application, obviously, the supplemental power.
Right, it's less power, and the key problem, it turns out, actually, with automobiles is that the internal combustion engine is just a dirt cheap way of producing a fair amount of drive for a car, a fair amount of power. And replacing that with a fuel cell is really a difficult cost challenge to get the cost down comparable to an internal combustion engine and produce the same kind of power. The other thing is that that you again have this issue of the fuel that you're using, and primarily people have been trying to use polymer-based fuel cells for that application, but the problem is that they require pure hydrogen as the fuel. So there are various scenarios, and I know that, David, you mentioned Argon, mm-hmm. having a fuel cell that runs directly off of gasoline. What they've actually been doing is they have a fuel preprocessor that actually converts the gasoline into pure hydrogen before it goes into the fuel cell.
Uh-huh.
That's a device called a fuel reformer. And that's certainly a viable option, but the difficulty there is that you have an additional device both to try to fit under the hood of the car, and it's also something that's going to tend to increase the overall cost of the system. Which is, it's already difficult to get it down to where an internal combustion engine is.
Okay, that's all I had.
All right, thanks. It sounds like we've got a number of engineering challenges here layered on top of the fact that we still have a lot invested in a particular kind of approach, a particular infrastructure, and that we're used to working with certain kinds of energy that comes in certain forms. And when you talk about doing something very dramatically different, like just, for example, to make the most extreme sort of example is going from using a liquid fuel like gasoline to hydrogen, which unless you have it very, very cold, it's not going to be a liquid. Then you start asking, well, you know, how do we handle it? How do we store it? How do we provide it to people? How do we design this new vehicle to deal with it? So we still got a number of pretty big problems to have to solve.
Right. I think everybody is sort of looking far ahead to a time when we're maybe running out of fossil fuels and we'll have hopefully gotten to a point where we can actually have a hydrogen economy. And there it's a beautiful scenario because there's really no pollution involved in that. The only byproduct is water that comes out of combusting air and hydrogen. But we're still a ways away from that. But there's some interesting things happening. For example, you heard in the news within the last month or so that General Motors bought a California company that had developed a new method for storing hydrogen with fairly high density. And that's really been one of the problems for the automotive application is using hydrogen. Not just, you know, where do you go to buy hydrogen to fill up your car,
yeah. But
how do you actually store it in the vehicle? And my understanding is that even if you were to use highly compressed hydrogen, like 5,000 PSI hydrogen tanks, the actual tank volume in your car would be something like 10 times the volume you have for your gas tank presently, which is probably a problem. So there's a need for a storage technology in order to be able to utilize hydrogen in an automobile as the prime fuel.
We have some other folks to talk with. Let's go to Urbana and line number one for another caller right here. Hello.
Yeah, I haven't heard you mention the catalyst too much in the way fuel cells are being visualized. Does there have to be a catalyst involved, and is it really critical to the whole thing?
That's a really good point. This is, again, another distinction between the low and high temperature fuel cells. Certainly, a lot of the low temperature fuel cells use a precious metal catalyst, typically platinum, to make the electrochemical reactions go at reasonable rates at low temperatures. And that has been an issue for making cost-effective fuel cells. And I know there's been a lot of efforts, for example, in the polymeric fuel cells to bring down the amounts of precious metals that they need in those to work well and then bring the cost down as a result of the reduced metal content. I guess one advantage people tout for solid oxide fuel cells is that because of the higher temperature, there's not as much need for precious metal catalysts. And in fact, typically they're not used at all. The catalyst on the anode of a solid oxide fuel cell is typically nickel, which is not terribly expensive. And on the cathode side, there's not really any catalyst used at all. It's just a ceramic material.
Huh. So it sounds like a lot of the economics of it maybe turn around the need for a catalyst. And can I ask you one more question? I remember there was in the popular press, there was this brouhaha a while ago, a year or two ago, about I don't know why this particular fuel cell got so much attention. Maybe it was just a slow news day or whatever, but I think it was called a Patterson fuel cell. But anyway, it was brought forward with a lot of fanfare, and in particular, the thing that caught my eye anyway was that U of I, somebody here at the U of I was working on, had been given a prototype, and that they were saying that more energy was coming out than was being put in, and they implied that the thermodynamics of the thing was not well understood. And I tried to find out through this, you know, just being nosy, I just tried to find out if if this story had any truth. The closest I could get was a graduate student who said that basically correct, that they were correct. They couldn't figure out why more energy was coming out than was going in. And I was just wondering just how was this mythology, or was this is there some sort of basis for this kind of reporting that in fact the thermodynamics of this device are not well understood, or are they?
Well, I think in general people believe they understand the thermodynamics of fuel cells rather well, and people would certainly be suspicious of a device in which you'd get more energy out than was put in the fuel going into it. it sounds a little bit similar to the big stink about cold fusion that happened, I don't know, what was that, about 10 years ago or so, in which they were reporting getting large amounts of power out of these devices that couldn't be explained. But I haven't heard specifically about a Patterson fuel cell, and I guess seems like I would have heard something more about it in the various conferences and in the symposia on fuel cells if there was really something to that.
So you're pretty confident about the theory involved?
Uh-huh.
Okay,
uh-huh.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. I guess that there, what that wouldn't that violate the rules of physics, getting more energy out than you put in? Isn't that not, we think that's not possible?
Sure, that's one of the basic ones. There's people have been trying to make perpetual motion machines for years and years, but one can usually figure out there's a trick somewhere involved in that.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left. We have a caller we'll get right to in just a second, but I do want to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Scott Barnett from Northwestern University. He's professor of materials science and engineering at the Robert McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science there at Northwestern. We're talking about fuel cells, and if you have questions, they're welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller from Southern Illinois on our line 4. Hello.
Thank you for having this guest. It's very interesting. I was wondering if there are any power plant companies in Illinois using fuel cells now, and where they are.
As far as I know, there are not. The only fuel cell power plants that are out there right now are actually demonstration power plants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any in Illinois. There are, I believe, some fuel cell buses that are being run in the Chicago area. I think there was 5 that were bought and are being tested out in the Chicago area. Those, again, are a demonstration. And I guess when I say demonstration, I just mean that those things are probably too expensive to be actually a commercial product yet. But people want to be able to go out and field test them and see how they really work in the real world.
Are there any companies in Illinois working on the technology to produce fuel cells?
Yes, there are. There's no large companies that I know of. There's a number of small companies. In fact, I'm associated with one up here in Evanston that's doing some fuel cell development.
And can you give me the name?
It's Applied Thin Films Incorporated.
And Plug Power, you mentioned earlier. Where are they from?
I believe they're out of California.
And a couple more questions. You mentioned other countries are working on fuel cell development. How far along are they compared to the United States? And are you getting any help from the Bush administration as far as funding or any interest from the Energy Department?
Well, actually, there has been good support in the last few years from the Department of Energy for fuel cell research. I don't know, maybe the Bush administration is too new to have had a lot of impact on the fuel cell funding, but there's a group at the National Energy Technology Laboratory that has had a lot of foresight in really pushing this fuel cell technology, even in a time a couple of years ago when it was political environment didn't seem to be that good for it. But they've been pushing the technology, and that's actually been very important because we do have competitors outside the United States. There's very active programs in Japan and throughout Europe in fuel cells.
They very far along?
I guess to assess them overall, I would say I wouldn't say that any particular country has a real lead right now in the various types of fuel cells. I guess I would also include Canada. Is actually a fairly big player in fuel cells.
Ballard is the
large company, and there's also a company called Global Thermal Electric that has, just in the last couple of years, developed a really big presence in solid oxide fuel cells.
Well, thank you very much. It's very important, and I look forward to having you back on the radio.
Okay.
Oh,
well,
thanks
for the call. Just now, out of curiosity, the demonstration buses that they're running in the Chicago area, what do they use for fuel?
Those, I believe, do use diesel fuel, and they use what I mentioned before, a fuel reformer system that will It's basically a small chemical processing plant that, that strips the hydrogen off the fuel and then supplies that to the fuel cell.
And what do they then produce as byproducts of all of this?
That would be primarily carbon dioxide and water.
Okay. So we still have a little carbon dioxide problem there.
Right. As long as you're using a fossil fuel, there's really no way to get around that. But again, the one advantage of a fuel cell, if you have higher efficiency, to get a certain amount of electricity, you're burning less fuel, and then you're also producing less CO2.
So your energy yield is more for the amount of emissions that you produce.
That's right.
Okay. Here's another caller, Clay City, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I work at a power plant, coal-fired in southern Illinois, and how long before I'm going to have to start worrying about my job? Is it 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road before, let's say, the average home will have a fuel cell set up in the yard just to supply their own needs and not have to buy off the grid? And what about blended technologies? Is there anything that coming along where they sort of use fuel cells and they sort of use a fossil and blend the two technologies together? Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know if I would worry about my job anytime soon, really. I think it's going to take a long time before everybody has a fuel cell and they're producing the power for their individual home. But the other thing I would mention is that there's a lot of interest, and this has been actually a traditional area of interest for many years, to use fuel cells as a method for utilizing coal as an energy source and trying to clean up the use of coal. In fact, I have a research program that's from the University Coal Research Program, where we're doing some of our fuel cell research. So, and I think also politically, there's a lot of interest, of course, in doing that, because there's a lot of states that have coal reserves. So that's going to remain a topic of interest, and maybe at some point your power plant will get converted to a fuel cell power plant, but still utilizing coal.
Hmm. But you wouldn't see that happening within the next 10 years, if not, maybe not even the next 20 years? Or can you even make a speculation like that?
Well, it's dangerous to speculate, but I would tend to follow what some of the larger developers are saying. For example, Siemens Westinghouse is probably the largest developers, one of the largest developers of solid oxide fuel cells in the U.S. And for example, they're now producing power plants that are up to, I think, a quarter of a megawatt power. And they're envisioning trying to get commercial plants into operation within something like 5 years. At least that's what they talk about at public meetings. You know, whether they really believe they can do that or not,
that's something else. Yeah. Let's see if we can squeeze one more caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in a little late, unfortunately. I was looking forward to this program. But anyways, as far as from an investment point of view, I think fuel cells someday are going to be quite profitable. What companies do you think would be good to invest in now, as far as looking at a profit down the road?
I think a big play has certainly been Ballard, that a company out of Canada. I think they're listed on NASDAQ. And that stock has done pretty well, particularly after, I think, Daimler Chrysler a few years back bought a significant fraction of that company. There's a lot of other companies, like I mentioned, like Siemens Westinghouse. Honeywell actually has a nice program in both polymer and solid oxide fuel cells. The problem with some of those larger companies, though, I guess, is that that's such a small fraction of their overall program that the fuel cells may not impact a lot. Their overall bottom line.
What about the company? I bought some stock in a company. I think it's just called Fuel Cell. It's FCEL is the what it trades under. Do you think some of those smaller companies will someday turn a profit?
That would probably be the way to go. Although I think it would be very speculative. It would probably be something comparable to buying Microsoft 20 years ago.
Right.
If you hit on the right one, you'd certainly make a ton of money.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay. We really haven't got very much time. One of the things that maybe we should have talked about is that we talked in the beginning about the basic idea of the fuel cell. You got your cathode, you got your anode, you got your chemical reaction there. It produces your energy. One thing that we didn't mention is that, and apparently, again, it's my understanding, that the individual fuel cell, you got one of those, that really doesn't produce very much energy. What you got to do is you got to have a whole bunch of them put together. How big a thing are we actually talking about if we're talking about, for example, something that would produce enough energy for a home? How big a device would we be talking about?
Just to use the example of this plug power unit, that I think it's something like on the order of the size of a dishwasher.
So that's not all that, no bigger than the furnace that people would have now.
Right, right. And the fuel cell stack, you know, a group of a large number of fuel cells can be up to something like a kilowatt per liter as far as the actual volume that's required. So it's actually a fairly high energy density. Now, that's just for the fuel cell itself. There's other things that have to go around in the package to bring in the fuel and the gas and take the electricity out and so forth. So it gets more, it takes more volume for the whole package, but they can be pretty compact.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've used the time, and it's something that perhaps in the future we can revisit. But for the moment, we want to say, Professor Barnett, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I also just wanted to say hello to everybody down in Champaign-Urbana and note that I actually lived in both Champaign-Urbana and Urbana for many years when I was a student down at U of I.
Well, that I noticed that, and I should have mentioned that you were a graduate student here, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, again, we appreciate you giving us your time, and also thanks very much to the folks there at Northwestern who made it possible for us to have this nice, high-quality connection.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Very good. And our guest, Scott Barnett, he's professor of materials science and engineering at the Robert R. McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science at Northwestern.